It's Parashat Mishpatim, page 416 in his Chumashim, in English Chumashim. It's been a while. So, welcome to a new term and lots of different exciting things happening this term at Bina. Before we start, just as I mentioned, there's a number of... Okay, are we ready? A number of different exciting things happening this term at Bina, new things. One of the things, in addition to the Monday night shiurim, which is given by Rabbi Chaitin, and part of it will give by myself, depending on which weeks, we also have a new Wednesday night series called The Journey of the Soul, which will be given by my son, Rabbi Levy, who's joined the Bina team, among many, many other new things. So check the emails and check the website, and there's lots on this week. Thursday morning, of course, is this Thursday morning starting. Also Thursday morning, we're starting a... Besides the regular Thursday morning, my son will also be giving, at the same time as our regular shiur, we'll be giving a what we call the Seniors for Men shiur. So older men who are not working or retired, whatever the case is, are welcome. We'll have a little discussion. We'll be up here, actually. What's that? So that's one of the new features.
One that really interested me, but being a nighttime, was the one on all the mod cons. Is that going to be recorded?
Unfortunately, yes, it started last night, and there was a problem with the recording, so last night actually wasn't recorded, but it will be recorded. Hopefully he'll do one last night again, maybe on recording, I'm not sure, so we'll try, we'll see what we can do. Okay, so what I'll do this week is, in Parsha Mishpatim, I'm going to spend a bit of time on something in the Parsha, which also connected to last week's Parsha, which is good because that'll give us a bit of an insight to last week's Parsha as well. Okay, so Parsha Mishpatim is a parsha packed with mitzvahs. We know, of course, last week we had the parsha to do with the giving of the Torah, the whole dramatic event of Har Sinai, Hashem appearing and revealing himself on the mountain of Sinai and giving us the Ten Commandments and so on. And then this week we get down to Tachlis, which is Hashem. Okay, Hashem gives us many, many of the mitzvahs which we have to then implement. The parsha is called Mishpatim, which we know, we've talked about this many, many times. It's page 416. The parsha is called Mishpatim, which, as we've mentioned many times, is a reference to particular mitzvahs, which are rational mitzvahs, although, and we've discussed this previously, although the parsha doesn't only include Mishpatim. It includes many, many things. It includes mitzvahs like Chukim, for example. This parsha is one of the three times it says we cannot mix meat and milk, which is not Mishpatim, it's one of the Chukim, it's one of the mitzvahs which we actually don't know the reason for. There's different philosophical things in this mitzvah, monetary laws which are more rational to do with damages, to do with guarding things, slavery, all. It's a very, very diverse parsha, but many, 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 many mitzvahs. I didn't hand out a summary of the parsha because just mitzvahs after mitzvah after mitzvah. And what we're going to do is we're going to touch on a few different points of the parsha briefly, but then I'm going to mainly focus on a very interesting thing at the end of the parsha. Because at the end of the parsha, suddenly there's a switch, quite a not well-known part of Parsha's Mishpatim, because everyone always gets bogged down in the first part. But it's a part of Mishpatim which suddenly the Torah goes back to the whole episode of Matan Torah. In the spirit, of course, of being no chronological order to the Torah, as we know, suddenly we get the whole details that were missing from the story of giving of the Torah suddenly feature at the end of this parasha, and we're going to focus on a very interesting pasuk that the Torah deals with. Okay, but I want to just touch on three things first. We'll just share with you three interesting insights to do with different things in the parasha. Can't touch on everything in the parasha, and then go to that part at the end. So the first insight I want to share with you has to do with the very first parasha of the Torah, which the very, very first part of Parashat Mishpatim, which has to do with the laws of the Hebrew slave, Eved Ivri, which we've gone into in different ways in previous years. But I want to just share with you one concept that comes from a sefer called Ois Desha, which is a son of the Ishbitzer Rebbe, who I mentioned previously because he's an ancestor of mine, so I often look at his forum. And this is a sefer of one of his sons, who's not my ancestor, but obviously a great-great-uncle of some sort. And he says a very interesting thing. He says that we need to understand that all the mitzvahs in this parasha, all the mitzvahs in the Torah, really, and This is a fundamental concept. Even when they no longer apply, or their details no longer apply, or they no longer apply for practical reasons because we don't live a particular lifestyle, whatever the case is, but they always apply. In other words, all 613 mitzvahs apply all the time. It's just a matter of applying on a practical level or being implemented on a more spiritual level. So, of course, the mitzvahs of slavery we don't have today. Not that we ever had them in the context that people understand them, because often it's very, very misunderstood. It's not slavery in like the American slavery era context, but it's a different type of slavery. But nevertheless, whatever it is, we don't have it today. We don't have this whole mitzvah today. But nevertheless, he says the mitzvah is applicable. And it's interesting because it actually must be applicable. It must be relevant because the Torah chose to put it as the first mitzvah of Mishpatim. So we have this whole dramatic event of Matan Torah last week. And suddenly says, okay, Hashem says, okay, now I'm going to tell you all the mitzvahs. What's the first mitzvah he tells us? Eved Ivri, which wasn't that applicable those days either. And it's certainly not relevant today on a practical level. So he says, what's the relevance? So first of all, just have a look. Let's have a look at the psukim. Just read a few psukim, page 416. And I'll share with you a nice thought that he says. He says the following. Let's have a look at the psukim. The Eile HaMishpatim, God says to Moshe Rabbeinu, these are the laws, Asher Tosim Lifneim, which you shall place before the Jewish people. Kisikne Eved Ivri, if you purchase a Jewish slave. Now, why is there a Jewish slave to begin with? Just so you understand. There's two reasons that a Jew can become a slave. It's more like a lease. It's like a six-year lease on a person's exclusive rights of work. Right? But why does that happen? Two reasons. Either because a person stole and can't pay back, and therefore the only way he can pay back is to lease himself out to someone for 6 years and go through the process of becoming what we call an Eved Ivri. Or a person reached such a level of poverty that he just has no way of funding himself, so he does this. This is like a desperate move to get on their feet financially, because during the time that he's working for the person for 6 years, if he's married with children, the master has a obligation to support his family as well. So it's a secure financial strategy to sort of get on your feet. Okay, so what happens? If you purchase a Jewish slave, Sheish Shonim Yavod, you should work for 6 years. Vashvi Yisrael Chavshei Chinam, you should go free in the seventh. Megapo Yavod, Megapo Yetziv, he goes in alone, he comes out alone, which means if he goes in unmarried, he comes out unmarried. Whatever that means. Imbal Isha Hu V'Yotze Ishta Imoy, if he's married, then of course his wife comes out with him. Meaning during the time as a slave, she's part of the experience because she's supported by the master. After that, that stops. Imadoyna Vitala Isha V'Yolda Rebonim Mevonis, if his master gives him a wife, which he's allowed to do if he's already married, and he gives birth to children, those should belong to the master, who Yetzay Gap, and he goes out without them. Now what happens at the end of the 6 years? As we know, Vim Omar Yoimar, however, if the slave suddenly says, no, I don't want to go free. Hafti Sadoni, I love my master, as Ishti, my new wife, as Bonai, my children. I don't want to go free. What happens? Vihigishoy Adoinov Elolakim, his master brings him to the Beistin, Vihigishov Adeles, and they will rule, and he should go next to the door. Or the doorpost, and the master will pierce his ears with a certain instrument, and we will continue to serve him forever. What's the idea? We know Rashi says because really it's a wrong thing to be exclusively sold to someone, because either it was a wrong thing to steal in the first place, or it's a wrong thing to go and acquire a master for yourself, because we are exclusively Hashem's slaves, Hashem's master, as servants. So therefore the idea of the mezuzah is either because the ear, first of all, the significance of the ear is that the ear that heard Hashem said Har Sinai we shouldn't steal, or said at Har Sinai that we should be Hashem's masters. And the same thing with the mezuzah, the doorpost, where the witnesses, when the Yidden went out of Mitzrayim and they smeared the blood on the doorpost with the Korban Pesach, that was testimony to the fact that Hashem was taking us out, making us free from Mitzrayim in order to be His slaves, His subjects. And nevertheless, this person went and bought his own master, or this person stole, whatever the case is, so that's like a punishment, and he continues to work forever. Forever doesn't mean forever. Forever actually means till the Jubilee year, till the Yovel, and then he must go free. Okay. So we don't have the practical application of this law today, so the Oyster Shep points out the following idea. And he says, if you see the contrast, actually interesting thing. Last week was this most lofty spiritual experience. We stood at Har Sinai, we stood at Mount Sinai. We know that when the Yidden stood at Har Sinai, it was an event and a moment that never existed previously in history and never will exist. Until Mashiach comes. Mashiach will be a whole different experience. But the clarity, the level of holiness, the elevation, the spirituality that was experienced at Har Sinai was unparalleled, can never be compared to anything else that ever happened or ever will happen. The Yidden reached an unbelievable moment of clarity, they reached an unbelievable moment of prophecy. They were on the highest level of divine exposure that a person could ever reach. And then he says, what suddenly happens is, what's the first mitzvah that Hashem gives us? Parshas Mishpatim. The way he terms it is, he uses a Talmudic phrase, Me'igra Rama Lebira Amikta. From the highest, tallest skyscraper to the lowest depths of a pit. All of a sudden, we're talking about a guy that's stealing, that doesn't understand his complete subservience to Hashem as our exclusive master, and the guy's in a mess. A person who has to go and work for someone else, only do very menial stuff for 6 years because he either stole or he's got punished or whatever. He's not in a very good spiritual state. So what's going on here? And why would Hashem give us that mitzvah right away after Matan Torah? So he explains the following. He says, the Torah is teaching us an important lesson. Hashem gave us the Torah, He brought us to this incredible level, but He says to us, you're not going to remain on this level. Because you're not, as we've spoken about many times, you're not angels, you're not all perfect, you're not tzaddikim, and the design of how you are is not meant to be that way. So there will be ups and there will be downs. You will go up and you will be down, and you will experience things where you are completely not on the level of Har Sinai. In fact, not only not on the level, but you will fall and you will fail. And you'll become subservient to other things other than God. You'll become subservient to your own evil inclination. You'll become subservient to other masters. And you will be not in a good state. But don't despair. Why? Because what you have to understand is that it's never all of you that will happen to. There will always be a part of you that will be free. For example, and Hashem says, Kisikne every 6 days you'll work, but on the seventh you'll go free. What's that an allusion to? The Mepharshim explain, that's an allusion to Shabbos. So first of all, even the week works like that. Even if you have to go through a week, and the week you suddenly lose your spiritual touch, and suddenly you're involved in the weekdayness, or you're involved in experiences which are very weekday-ish, very mundane, understand there will be a Shabbos. There will always be times in your life, moments, days, experiences, Shabbos-like experiences that will allow you to reignite, to rediscover your essential connection to Hashem, which ultimately is never ever lost. This actually, he doesn't say this, but this is connected to another concept which is explained by the Mefarshim, if I'm not mistaken, the Orach Chaim or the Kli Yoka, one of them says it. And he says, what's the idea of the sixth and the seventh? He says that everything in the world is made up of six sides. There's always the top, the bottom, and the four directions. That's the external. The seventh is the core and the essence of everything. Slavery is only applicable externally. When we become slaves to other people, slaves to Golas, slaves to Ayetzahara, ultimately it remains an external thing. Hashem warns us it's going to happen. We're not going to always feel this Matan Torah experience. But when you do fail, which you will, when you do lose your touch, which you will, understand that's just external. The seventh, the core, the essence of who you are, is always there. And you're always able to reignite it. Hinted in the Shabbos experience. You just had a weekday experience, but there's a Shabbos. A Shabbos you can tap into the higher level of your Jewishness. And he goes further and he says, and the Torah continues and says, what happens if the guy says, I don't want to go out on the seventh? In other words, the person has sunken so low that he's not aware of that seventh. He's not aware of Shabbos. Shabbos doesn't do it for him. It's not working to ignite. So then the person can really despair. So he says, okay, well, that's the case. I'm essentially enslaved. So he says, no, because the Torah says that you will go to the mezuzah, you will go to the doorpost. The doorpost reminds us of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Once Hashem took a Jew out of Mitzrayim, we were essentially free. Even if the freedom is so hidden that even the seventh doesn't do it for us. Ultimately it'll come out. A Yid is never lost. You always have the Yetzias Mitzrayim, you always have the freedom given to us at Egypt that is always there. Says the Noah Tesha, that's why this is the first mitzvah after Mishpatim. It's a warning sign before we go into all other mitzvahs. I gave you the Torah, I lifted you up, understand that it's going to be a struggle. But don't despair, because that struggle is external. You always have the seventh, and if the seventh doesn't work, remember Yetzias Mitzrayim, ultimately it'll come out, you're always essentially free, and there's always a pathway somewhere along the line back to that essential connection. That's why it's the first mitzvah. Okay, that's one idea. Another idea I wanted to share with you is just an interesting part of the parsha, and just share with you an interesting idea. If you go to page 420, And it's just an example of how Torah works and how Torah Shabbat Peh works. It's just a side detail, but we learn a very fundamental thing from it. It's talking about an argument that people have, and a person injures his friend. So we learn about the halachas of what you have to do when you injure someone. What are the compensation? What are the payments? So we know essentially there's five types of payments that are possible. Compensation for losing work, compensation for medical fees, and so on and so forth. Embarrassment, fines, different things that you have to pay someone if you injure them. So if you look at just the second to last line of the page, it says, Rak shifto yitain. You see the end of that pasuk, the end of pasuk 19. It says, you shifto yitain means you have to pay him for his lost time. Virapoi yirape, and he should provide the healing. It's a double expression, like refuah. Virapoi yirape, he should provide his healing, which on a simple level means you should pay for his medical bills. If you injured him and he had to go through a medical procedure or medical healing, you've got to pay for his medical bills. But the Gemara says something very fascinating on this. What's the double expression, virapoi yirape? Says the Gemara, Mikan shenitan reshus leroife lerapes. From here we learn that permission was given to a doctor to heal. Now in English, doctor and healing is a different word, but in Hebrew a lot of times we have the nouns and the verbs are the same words. That's what leroife lerapes. To a doctor, roife, same word. Lerapes, to heal, which is the same word, refuah, healing, right? Now it's an interesting expression. What do you mean doctor, permission was given to a doctor to heal? To us, we take it for granted. Obviously, if you're sick, you go to a doctor, right? But actually, the great philosophers and the great Rishonim and the Gemara actually discussed this. Because as a Yid, we don't just... Actually, it's not just taken for granted. How do we know that we can go to a doctor? In other words, if you think about it, it's an interesting thing. Going to a doctor is actually interfering with Hashem's plan. If Hashem decreed upon a person to become unwell, well, maybe that's his plan. What gives us the mission to... Right? It gives you a little bit of insight that everything we do as Yidden is according to Torah. It's not like Torah is 630 mitzvahs and the rest of my life I'll run the way I need to run it. A true commitment of a Jew is that every part of who we are is run up with Torah. And we have to question it. We have to reflect. Is what I'm doing correct, legitimate? Doesn't matter what it is. It has to be a source. As we know, the Torah is the blueprint for creation. Therefore, there has to be a source in Torah for everything that we do, including going to that. Right? So therefore, the fact that we have medical, and the Torah says, Rapa Yerapa, no, it means that the Torah gives us permission to heal, and therefore Hashem does what he needs to do, but he's given us the mandate of living natural lives, and he tells us, notwithstanding the fact that he sent the disease, because we believe that everything's from Hashem, he wants us now to do what is necessary naturally to get rid of it. Whether we're successful or not depends on him, but we have to be positive, or we have to believe that we can do it. And that's what he wants, for whatever reason that he wanted us to go through that process. Another twist on that expression has often been quoted, I'll just share with you, that Mikan, from here we learn, Shenitan Rishus, permission was given to the doctor to heal. What does that mean? Doctors have permission to heal, but that's all they have permission to do. Not to give negative prognosis. Interesting twist on that. They have the mission to heal. Right? Because they don't know. We know so many stories where things happen and doctors predict and it doesn't turn out that way. It turns out much, much, much better. And then doctors have to be aware that they are given permission, and being a doctor is a big mitzvah, and helping another person is an unbelievable thing. But you have to have permission from Hashem for that, because everything we have to have permission from Hashem. Where does it go to? Lerapo is to heal. That's all your permission goes. Other than that, you have no permission. Interesting idea.
Yes. So would a religious doctor not ever turn
No, what a doctor can do is he can do whatever's necessary for the person to do to take the best care. So there's a whole medical discussion about that. No, a doctor can never say definitively you've got 3 months. That's a ridiculous thing to say. A doctor can say that this is serious, like this is a serious situation because of what you need to do for it. Or if a doctor sees that the end is near, he can advise a family that, look, and the wording has to be very careful. In the world of nature, al pi teva, according to normal statistics, this looks very serious. You want to call your family to say goodbye, that's a good time to do it. But he can't say definitively that's no, it's 4 days or 5 weeks or whatever. No, definitely not. I know, of course they do, but that's not correct. An interesting question on the subject, I'll just share with you an interesting thing that I was reading about this. I came across an interesting shaila, which I've seen before, but it was a shaila put to Moshe Feinstein, also about refuah. It was an interesting question. It was a question about a person who was sick, and the doctors had told him that he must not fast Yom Kippur because it's essential that he has liquids. Right? So therefore, we know that sometimes that's true, and a person cannot fast. It's dangerous to fast. So this person didn't need to eat, but he needed hydration, and therefore it was absolutely important that he did not fast Yom Kippur and he drank. So the person was desperate to fast. So he asked Moshe Feinstein a shaila, would he be permitted the day before Yom Kippur to check himself into a clinic or at home to get a nurse, whatever, and to give himself intravenous IV? And he'll hydrate himself that way. So he won't need to take liquid because you can be hydrated through intravenously, and that's not a problem. So are you allowed to do that? Right. So there's a big discussion among the Poskim about that, whether that's a legitimate thing to do. And the answer was that no. Number one, you don't have to do it, even if you have the opportunity to do it. And number two, you're actually not allowed to do it for the following reason. Interesting, a whole interesting, fascinating perspective on our bodies, right? Because we believe our bodies don't belong to us. Nothing belongs to us. It belongs to Hashem. So it's borrowed. We're on borrowed time here. It's given to us for a mission, for a purpose, right? He says, first of all, Hashem gave us a mitzvah to fast Yom Kippur, and the same God said that in certain circumstances you don't have to fast. He didn't say you have to go and do all sorts of medical acrobatics in order to fast. Right? I mean, you have to do medical acrobatics to be healthy. So yes, if a person knows if he does something 3 months before Yom Kippur, it's going to jeopardize his fasting, so he shouldn't do it for a different reason. He shouldn't do it because he shouldn't do something that's going to cause you to be... Right? Or if a person, let's say, is going to take an operation a few days before Yom Kippur, and it's an elective surgery that can wait 2 months without any problem, so that's, a person shouldn't do that. Go put himself into a situation that he won't be able to fast. That's not a good idea. But if he's already in that situation, and Halacha says you don't have to fast, that's it, you don't have to fast. So you don't have to go and be cleverer than the Torah. Secondly, he says, actually not allowed to. Because we know that, and again, you know, I was talking before, you need permission from God to go to a doctor. We also need permission from Halacha to have an operation. Because actually any procedure we have, right, any procedure we have, at any time, actually goes against another Torah principle. It's completely prohibited to injure ourselves. Right? It's called choivel ba'atzmai. We're not allowed to injure ourselves. I'll tell you an interesting, relevant outcome of this in a second. Why, therefore, are we allowed to have an operation? Because the Torah says you're allowed to. It depends what the benefit will be. Because every time we injure ourselves, we're risking ourselves. We're injuring a body that doesn't belong to us, number one. And number two, we are putting ourselves at risk. Every operation is a risk at the end of the day. However, if the medical benefit outweighs the risk, then we're allowed to do it. And that's the hepta. That's the reason that we can take an operation. But if it's an injury to ourselves that has no benefit, no medical benefit, and the Torah doesn't say you have to do it, then you're not allowed to do it. So Sarah Moshe Feinstein, it doesn't matter how small the procedure is, but the fact is, when you take intravenous, you have to injure yourself. It's an injection. It's never risk free, and it's chayvul ba'atzmo. You are injuring yourself intentionally. Now, of course, you can do it if you need to take a blood test or if you think, because there's a medical benefit. But just to fast Yom Kippur, and the Halacha doesn't say you're allowed to do that. So therefore, not only wouldn't you be allowed to do that, wouldn't you have to do that? You wouldn't be allowed to do that. And that was a really very interesting thing. This concept of the way of operation and goes to the whole idea of cosmetic surgery, which is a very, very, I'm not, I'm, it's not, yeah, which is not the time for it now. Yeah, it's a very, very long complication, because there are cases where cosmetic surgery is allowed for if it has psychological benefits. But pure cosmetic surgery that has no other benefit other than cosmetic outcomes is actually very problematic. Okay, sometimes we do things, you know.
It's a bit weird, I apologize. I was just thinking, and I know I'd walk away thinking, I just should have asked.
No, it's a good question. I don't know. I don't know what the medical side of that is. It depends if it's unhealthy or not. But a person should, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But the general principle is a person should always do things that are safe. If you're not sure, check with a health practitioner. Anyway, so the last little thought I wanted to share with you before I go into the main thing of the shir is just also an interesting thing about a mitzvah that does apply today, but the details are not relevant to most of us, and yet it is. Again, with this principle that everything in the Torah has relevance. I'll just show you where it is. Have a look at page 434. And it's one of the many places in the Torah where it mentions the mitzvah of Shabbos. Okay. Now, just to give you a background, one of the mitzvahs of Shabbos, and this is last week's parasha as well, in the Ten Commandments, is that when a Jew keeps Shabbos, his animals have to keep Shabbos too. Do you know that? Are you aware of that? So, for example, a Jewish farmer cannot have his ox, even if someone else does it, plow on Shabbos. If that animal belongs to you, it cannot do it. So much so that I'll share with you a story. Famous story, a story.
Because you derive the benefit.
No, not because of the benefit. It's a special din in the Torah. I don't have the story in front of me, but there's a special din in the Torah that animals have to rest as well. Because your slaves have to rest, your family has to rest, and your animals have to rest, right? So much so that I've forgotten now who it was in the Gemara, but there was a fascinating story in the Gemara where a great sage sold his ox. He sold his ox to a non-Jew, and he sold it on Sunday. And he said to the non-Jew, it's an excellent ox, a great working ox. And the guy started to work the ox, and Sunday, Monday, the whole week, the ox was working brilliantly. Come Shabbos, he cannot budge this ox. And he says, what do you mean? He sold me a lemon. Well, once a week, this guy doesn't work. What kind of nonsense is this? Right? So, an ox or a donkey, I don't remember what it was. Was it a Pinchas? Sorry? A cow, it says, maybe, yeah.
I was going to say the cow.
I'm not sure it was. Okay, whatever it was, yeah. Anyway, so he went back to him and says, I'm sorry, it worked for all week, but no, the price I paid was for 7 days. So the guy smiled and he said, okay, let me fix this. So he goes over to the non-Jewish neighbor's field, he goes over to the cow, he whispers something in the cow's ear, and the cow starts to work. So the guy says to him, excuse me, now you're giving magic, the black magic, what is this now? He says, no, that wasn't black magic, I just want you to know, you have to understand, this cow used to belong to me, on Shabbos it doesn't work. But I whispered to the cow that you're allowed to work now because unfortunately I had to sell you because I didn't have enough money. So now you belong to a non-Jew and it's okay to work. The non-Jew became so impressed with how this works that he converted and became Jewish. And the cow didn't work anymore. No, because the Gemara gives us an example that there were certain animals that belonged to tzaddikim were so refined, like they were so elevated that they became part of them. Obviously, if we had an animal that we didn't work on Shabbos and sold a non-Jew, believe me, it would work. But the great tzaddikim that had such an effect, that's why we're right. So this is repeated in this week's parasha, but it's repeated in an interesting way. Let's have a look. And it says, Sheshes Yomim, it's on page 434, verse 12. Sheshes Yomim, Tase Ma'asecha. For 6 days you should do what you need to do. Vayom Ashvi Tishbeis. On the seventh day you should rest. Lama'an. So that your ox and donkey will rest, and the maidservant, son, and the stranger, they will all rest. They'll be refreshed. See, here's some with very strange wording. It almost sounds like the purpose of Shabbos is for the donkey to have a rest. Now, it's one thing if you say, like in Aseres Hadibros, that there's a mitzvah to keep Shabbos, and when you keep Shabbos, it's not only you, part of the halachas of Shabbos, for whatever reason, so Hashem wants your donkey to rest as well. Here it doesn't say it that way. Here it says, you should keep Shabbos in order that your donkey should rest. Right? Amazing thing. And also, again, what's the relevance to us? Most of us today are not farmers. We're not plowing fields with cows and bulls and donkeys. So what's the relevance to us? But this is the relevance. So I saw a vort in one of the svarim from the Imre Emes, one of the Gerer Rebbes. He says the following. He says, no, Torah is telling us of the whole purpose of Shabbos. The shorcha v'chamorcha here, the ox and the donkey that he's talking about in this pasuk, is not the real ox and donkey. It's the ox and donkey which is in us. As we've spoken about many times, we all have an animal within us. We all have the godly soul, and we all have the animal soul. Each one of us suffers from a different animal soul, right? We have some people's ox, some people's donkey, some people's sheep, whatever the animal part of our personality is. And during the week, we have a lot of tension. During the week, the animal part of us resists, fights, takes us off the path, and wages a war with our godly soul. The purpose of Shabbos is to have one day a week where there's inner peace. Because we know that the whole idea of Shabbos is that the truth is revealed. The power of Shabbos is that Hashem's creative power is revealed. We stop and disconnect from the world so that we should be able to reveal in the entire world that everything ultimately, despite its differences and variety and diversity and conflicting creations and so on and so forth, as we've explained before, all come together under the one banner because the creative power of Shabbos, of Hashem's creation is revealed. And therefore, that's the pshat that Shabbos gives rest. Rest doesn't mean a holiday. Rest means inner peace. On Shabbos, we have this time to take our time to realize that actually there's no conflict. That the animate soul, the godly soul, the different jobs, the different conflicting things, really all under, at the end of the day, all come under one banner. They're all able to be compatible with God and godliness and serving God. During the week, that's not so apparent. During the week, we have to struggle to reveal that. Shabbos is the one day. So the Torah is telling us, why does an ox and donkey have to rest? Because of the ox and donkey within ourselves. Because everything rests on Shabbos. Everything comes together under that banner of inner peace. And that's what the Torah says, Vayom Hashvi Tishba is the seventh day you should rest, Laman, in order that your ox and donkey should rest. In other words, that's actually the purpose of Shabbos, to bring every part of us, including the ox and donkey, under the banner of true rest, which means inner peace and no inner conflict. Just some thoughts on the parasha. Nice thoughts. Now,
what about your cow? Do you have to milk them?
That's a very interesting question. So, just to answer briefly, because we would probably need a whole shir, the halacha is pre-modern technology. In olden times, halacha was like this, that you're not allowed to milk a cow on Shabbos, but what do you do? The cow's going to be in pain. So you're allowed to milk it in a way where it's not considered the true biblical violation of milking a cow, which means you milk it, but you don't use the milk. So in olden times, they would milk the cows onto the ground on Shabbos and not use the milk. They would milk it just for the purpose of the animal, but not actually use the milk. Nowadays, a lot of companies have milk machines on timers and all kinds of things. I think they've developed a sophisticated form of doing it on a timer, which actually becomes permitted, and they could use the milk. But yeah, but there is a problem with milking a cow on Shabbos. Okay. Now, I want to take you back, take you now to the last part of the parasha. Go to page 440. Now, what's interesting is, again, based on the principle, Ein muktim u'me'ucher ba'Torah, there is no order to the Torah. And the Torah picks the story of Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah, to teach us this in a very big way. When the Jews went out of Mitzrayim, let me give you the background. When the Jews went out of Mitzrayim, they traveled for the 6 weeks, 7 weeks, and they came on Rosh Chodesh Sinai to Midbar Sinai. Okay? That's last week's parasha tells us that. Then there were 6 days depending which view we hold, leading up to Matan Torah, and then on the 6th of Sivan, or the 7th of Sivan, depending on which opinion, the Torah was given. After the Torah was given, Moshe Rabbeinu was called up to the mountain, which was the form of ascending to heaven, for 40 days to learn Torah from Hashem, and to receive the Luchos, to see the tablets, to bring them down. Okay. What happens in this week's parasha is, many of the details, what actually happened before Matan Torah, are not in last week's parasha. For whatever reason, Hashem leaves them out and brings them into this week's parasha. Part one. And part two, Hashem then introduces us to part two, which is, He asks Moshe Rabbeinu to come up on the mountain and spend 40 days there. Okay? Let's have a look at some of this. For example, we all know one of the most fundamental parts of the giving of the Torah was Na'aseh V'Nishma. Right? When did the Yidden say Na'aseh V'Nishma? Sorry?
To see and hear.
Yeah, but when did they say it? No. They said it the day before Matan Torah. According to most opinion, they said it on the 5th of Sivan. Yeah, the day before. Moshe Rabbeinu said, I'm about to give you the Torah. I want to make it into a covenant. You've got to prepare. And they said, yeah, we're going to accept it. Whatever Hashem is going to tell us tomorrow, Na'aseh V'Nishma. Right? Where's that written? Not in last week's parasha. This week's parasha. Mishpatim, yeah, but it actually happened before. Happened way before. It's all out of order, completely out of order, everything over here. Right? One of the things the Jews did before Matan Torah is they prepared, they went to mikveh. In fact, we know the laws of conversion from Matan Torah, because all the Jews were converts. When they left Egypt, they had to circumcise themselves. There were some sacrifices they brought, which we don't do today because we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. They had to accept the mitzvahs, which is Nasa V'Nisma, and they had to go to mikveh, which is in this week's parasha. Not last week's parasha, this week's parasha. Right? So it's interesting. Yeah, because there were different kinds of converts. We were all converts, but part of the original covenant and ancestry of Avraham Avinu, which still gave us the soul, didn't make a halachic to be Jewish, where the Arab rabbis were completely non-Jews and they became Jewish. Yeah, so there wasn't.
They were different conversions?
They were conversions from a different level. In other words, they were conversions from being complete non-Jews. The Jewish, that's another whole other discussion. You're going to have to come to the Wednesday night series to understand this. He's going to go through that. No, because it's a very interesting, exactly what status Avraham Avinu was. In fact, it goes, Adam HaRishon already had the soul, the Jewish soul. In fact, we learn the pasuk of the soul from Adam HaRishon. But we say Avraham Avinu was the first Jew, and yet they weren't Jewish until they left Mitzrayim, or they stood at Matan Torah. So exactly what happened at each stage is a fascinating topic. And I think it's going to be included in that series. So here's a plug for the series. But, okay. So let's have a look. We don't learn all the psukim. Let's have a look at some of the psukim. Again, so part one of what I'm about to show you is pre-Matan Torah. Part two is post-Matan Torah, the 40 days. Although in part two, there's a pasuk that takes us back to before Matan Torah also, which I'm going to show you, which is all over the place, this whole thing. And then at the very end, there's a very fascinating pasuk, which I want to focus on. Let's see, I'll try and manage this all. That's page 440, chapter 24. New chapter, new paragraph in Parshas Mishpatim. Says the Chumash.
Can you say the number in Hebrew? Sorry.
Perek Chaf Aleph.
Thank you.
Perek Chaf Aleph, Pasuk Aleph.
Yeah.
Says the Torah. Ve'al Moshe Amar and Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu, this is pre-Matan Torah, Alei al Hashem. Come up to God. Atah v'Aaron, you and Aaron, Nadav v'Aviv, v'Shim v'Zikne Yisrael. First of all, you should approach Har Sinai with Aaron, with Nadav and Aviv, and the 70 elders. And Mishtachavisim Erochek, and you should bow down from afar. They shouldn't all come up on the mountain. Then Venigash Moshe Levadoi, Moshe Rabbeinu went close to the mountain himself. Al Hashem Vehim Lo Yigoshu, they didn't go close. Ve'om Lo Yalu Imoy, and the nation did not go up with him. In other words, only Moshe Rabbeinu himself went on Har Sinai. And then Vayovan Moshe Rabbeinu came back, because you have to understand, in those 6 days before Matan Torah, Moshe Rabbeinu went up and down with different messages, with different mitzvahs they had to be told. And one day they were told they're going to be a special nation. The next day they were told they have to separate from their wives in preparation for purity for Matan Torah. So there was different instructions happening over those days. So it comes then, Moshe Rabbeinu comes down, and he told him, it's called Divrei Hashem, all the words of Hashem. He told him some of the laws. He gave him a sneak preview. He reviewed the laws that had already been given in a place called Mara, which was before they got to Har Sinai. And everyone answered, and they said, whatever Hashem said, we will do. Not Nasi V'Nishma just yet, but do. Then an interesting thing happened. By the way, there's a few different opinions how to read some of these psukim. I'm just taking one of them for the purpose of this discussion. Vayichtov Moshe is called Divrei Hashem. Moshe Rabbeinu wrote down all the words of Hashem. What exactly did he write? Rashi says he wrote the whole Torah from Bereshis until that point. That was the first beginning of the writing of the Torah. Right, he wrote down the whole Torah from Bereshis till that point. I asked him, Moshe, Baba, got up in the morning. We have a mizbech tachasar, and he built a mizbech. Shteim esrei matzeva, 12 monuments. Shteim ashif to Yisrael for the 12 tribes and so on. Okay, then he sprinkled blood on them. Skip a few lines and go to verse 7. This was now up to now the 5th of Sivan, the day before the giving of the Torah. Vayikach sefer abris. He took this covenant book of covenant which he'd written down. Vayikra ba'ozne ha'om, and he read it in the ears of the people. Vayomer, and they said, "Kol asher diber Hashem, whatever Hashem said, nase v'nishma." Here's their nase v'nishma. Then he went up, the whole thing, and they saw God. They saw thing, and then there was the Matan Torah, which the Torah does not mention Matan Torah in this week's parasha, because that's what we read last week's parasha. So that's just the missing pieces. Now go to the next page, page 442, pasuk Yudeis, verse 12. Suddenly, this is why, by the way, you have to read Sukkim with Torah Shavuot Peh. I mean, like, it's impossible to know what's going on here without the Gemara, without Rashi. Ayomer Hashem el Moshe. Suddenly Hashem said to Moshe, no warning, by the way. We have to now remember that now a whole new episode took place, i.e. giving of the Torah, which was last week's parasha. Suddenly, Ayomer Hashem el Moshe, Hashem said to Moshe, Alei Eli Hohora. Come up to me, to the mountain. Ve'yesham, and stay there for 40 days. I'm going to give you the tablets. The Torah, the Mitzvah. I'm going to give you the Torah and the Mitzvah, which the Rambam explains. Torah is reference to the written Torah. Mitzvah is a reference to the oral Torah. Asher kasafti leheroisam, which I've written down to teach them. Okay. What happens? Vayakom Moshe v'Yeshua m'sharstei. Moshe Rabbeinu gets up, and he's Yeshua. Yeshua is his attendant, his close disciple. Vayal Moshe harlekim, but only Moshe went up to the mountain. Okay. And then Velaskenim Omar. So what happened was he went up on the mountain. Yeshua stayed at the foot of the mountain. Because we know that later on, we know that when they served the golden calf, Yeshua didn't know what was going on. Moshe when it comes down the mountain, and Yeshua says to him, I don't know, but there's trouble there. I don't know what's going on in the camp, but there's trouble. So there was the whole camp, Yeshua at the foot of the mountain, and Moshe Rabbeinu is on top of the mountain for the 40 days. And then he says, by the way, Velaskenim Omar. And he said to the elders, Shuvalon of Azeh, stay here, Asher Adash Anosh Valechem, stay until we return. And Vinei Aaron V'chur Imochem, I'm leaving with you Aaron, Chur, who is Miriam's grandson. Mi Bal Dvorim, Mi Gashalem, they're in charge while I'm away. Anyone has a problem, come to them.
What were the 70 elders doing during the Feta Eagle?
Sorry?
What were the 70 Canaan doing during
the Feta Eagle? Well, Aaron, Chur they killed. Chur tried to stop them and they killed Chur. That's one of the stories that it goes off. Aaron employed strategies to try and delay them, which didn't work. And the rest of them were powerless. That's what Parshas Kisisa. Okay. Now says the Psukim, now listen carefully. The next two Psukim, are actually go back now to pre-Matan Torah. Okay? According to one opinion. I'm reading this according to one way of understanding it. Because in order for Moshe Rabbeinu to experience... Torah is going to highlight us now. In order for Moshe Rabbeinu to experience what he experienced for the 40 days, he needed 6 days of preparation before Matan Torah. Says the Pasuk, Vaya'al Moshe El Hahar. Moshe Rabbeinu went up on the mountain. This is now before Matan Torah. He went up and down the mountain. And says the Torah, Vayechas Ha'onon Esahar. The cloud was covering the mountain. So for 6 days already, there was a cloud covering the mountain. Then it says, "Vayishkoin kvoid Hashem al Har Sinai." The glory of Hashem dwelled in Har Sinai. "Vayechaseu ha'anon," and the cloud covered the mountain, Sheshes Yamim, for 6 days. As I said, this is not a normally learned part of Parshas Mishpatim because we get so bogged down about so many details until this part. This part is never dealt with in depth. "Vayikra el Moshe v'yemashvi," and on the seventh day, Hashem called to Moshe mitoicha ona, which Rashi says actually he didn't call to Moshe, he called to the whole Jewish people. But he means because that's when he gave the seventh day was the giving of the Torah. So he had 6 days preparation, seventh day. And then, this is all the parentheses, and then go back to the day after. Hashem says, now come up, now you're ready to come up for 40 days, and I'm going to teach you the whole Torah. Now says the Pasuk, Moshe Rabbeinu went up for the 40 days, umare kvoid Hashem, the appearance of the glory of God. Ke'esh oicheles, listen carefully, it was like a consuming fire, b'roi shahar, on the top of the mountain, le'enei b'nei Yisrael, to the eyes of the Jewish people. What they saw was something similar to a consuming fire on top of the mountain. Ayova Moshe b'soicha onan, and Moshe Rabbeinu went into the cloud. This is now post-Matan Torah, right? He went into the cloud before Matan Torah, but this is post-Matan Torah. He went into this cloud. Vayala lahor, he went up on the mountain. Vayihi Moshe, and he was there. Bahor, on the mountain. Arboim yoim, arboim laila, 40 days and 40 nights. Good. That's the story. So there were 6 days of preparation where there was a cloud, and Moshe was going up and getting messages and coming back to the Jewish people and telling him what to do before Matan Torah, and himself was getting elevated and preparing for the 40 days. Seventh day, Hashem calls to the whole B'nai Yisrael, gives them the 10 commandments, singles out Moshe because he was the main one. Then Hashem says, come up now and stay here for 40 days. Then there's this seeing a fire, consuming fire on top of the mountain. Moshe Rabbeinu goes into the cloud and he's there for 40 days and 40 nights. He disappears in the cloud and he's there for 40 days and 40 nights. Then, all of a sudden, on this last pasuk, there's a very strange Rashi. Rashi says, if you can read the Rashi, it's in one sentence. If you can't read the Rashi, don't worry. The Soicha Onan, all of a sudden Rashi decides to comment on what this cloud means. Oh, that cloud like 55 times already now, but all of a sudden Rashi decides, let's explain the word cloud. Says Rashi, Onan Zeh, this cloud, Kamin Oshonhu, was actually like smoke. Ashes, smoke. V'asalai HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Hashem made for Moshe Rabbeinu, L'Moshe, Shvil B'Soichai. He made a pathway to go into the smoke. Because how can you go into smoke? So Hashem made a pathway to go for Moshe Rabbeinu. That's all Rashi says. So I'm going to share with you, I'm going to give you the crux of it. There was a fascinating talk by the Rebbe who used to tackle Rashi very often. And he explains Rashi on two levels. Often when the Rebbe would explain Rashi, he would first explain the simple pshat of Rashi, why Rashi, what was bothering Rashi, why Rashi had to say it, and so on and so forth. And then he would give a deeper layer to the Rashi. So I'm going to try and share with you both of those things. So first of all, what's going on here? First of all, why do we have to change the name? There's a cloud. What's the problem with the cloud? There was a cloud covering Har Sinai. We've had this before. It says before the cloud was covering Har Sinai. And if a cloud, by the way, is not smoke. Smoke comes from fire. Cloud comes from water, actually. So it's an evaporation of water, number one. Number two, if there's a cloud, you don't need a pathway. I mean, it might be turbulence, as you know, when you go to a plane, it goes through a cloud, there's a bit of shakiness, but you don't need a pathway, you can go through a cloud. Right? So up to now, we've learned that the cloud was on Har Sinai, representing the glory of Hashem, was there for the 6 days before, so what's wrong with it continuing to be there? Also, why does Rashi need to all of a sudden say that Moshe needed a pathway? And why does Rashi suddenly explain the cloud? Is this what all the time the cloud means? In other words, what's going on? The simple pshat to the Rashi is as follows. Rashi is forced to re-explain this cloud, right? Because of two things. There's two things bothering Rashi. First of all, he's bothered, why does the pasuk suddenly have to say that Moshe Rabbeinu went into the cloud? We know that there was a cloud there. The 6 days of preparation, it says there was a cloud constantly covering Har Sinai. So if Moshe, now we know that Hashem said to Moshe, please stay on the mountain or come back up on the mountain for 40 days, we know there's a cloud in Har Sinai. So why does the pasuk need to repeat that Moshe Rabbeinu went up in the cloud? We just had it 5 psukim ago. Okay, the 5 psukim was a different cloud, it was a cloud before Har Sinai. But why do we have to have a repetition of this cloud? We know there's a cloud in Har Sinai, number one. Number two, Rashi's bothered by a different thing. The pasuk before deviates from the cloud. It says there was a cloud on the mountain. And then suddenly the pasuk says that the glory of Hashem was like a consuming fire. Well, 1 second, was it a cloud or was it a consuming fire? It says Rashi, what happened was like this. Until Matan Torah, there was a cloud. The glory of Hashem, a cloud. But when Matan Torah happened, there was fire. In fact, last week's parsha, when the Torah was given, is the first time the pasuk says explicitly, the Har Sinai Oshan Kuloi, the mountain of Sinai was smoking. It says it was smoking, last week's parsha. And then it says all of a sudden that the cloud, that the mountain was, now Moshe Rabbeinu goes up for 40 days, the mountain was covered in the cloud. It says Rashi, if you understand, I read the psukim. The cloud before was a cloud. But now the pasuk talks about a fire, and then the pasuk repeats that Moshe Rabbeinu went up in a cloud. This is for the 40 days. It says Rashi, it's not the same cloud. The reason that it's repeated is because it's a different cloud now. Now that we have the fire, now the cloud on Har Sinai was a different cloud. It was a cloud actually coming from smoke that the fire generated. That's why Rashi says, Onan, this cloud is actually Kamin Oshan, it's like smoke. And therefore Hashem had to create a pathway for Moshe Rabbeinu to go through. Because you can't go into smoke, it's got to be a pathway. Problem is, that's very nice. Problem is, if it's a different cloud, right? And this cloud is not a cloud made out of water, but it's a cloud actually, like we say, a cloud of smoke. You don't mean a cloud of smoke, because you have a tornado, like whatever you call it, a volcano, I mean. Right? It's like a volcanic ash, right? It's also a cloud, but it's a cloud of ash. It's a cloud of smoke, right? But if it's a different cloud, so why does the Torah call it a cloud? If the Torah wanted to tell us that for the first 6 days there was a cloud on Har Sinai, then Hashem gave the Torah and there was an explosion of fire on Har Sinai, and then Hashem told Moshe to come for 40 days, and Hashem went up on the mountain, and the mountain was covered by the smoke of that fire, So call it what you called it on the day of Matan Torah. Call it smoke, as the Torah does. If you have a, if you want to have a quick look, because I want you to have a look at that pasuk, you'll see an interesting thing. Oh yeah, go to page 404. All right, and this is the day of Matan Torah, page 404, pasuk 18. Says the pasuk, the Har Sinai. Oh, you have it there. The Har Sinai Oshan Kula. The Har Sinai was smoking. Why? Because the fire of Hashem. If Hashem Baish, Hashem came down in fire. And the smoke was, the ash was going up like the ash of a furnace. And the mountain was shaking. Now, so why not call it smoke here? Call it smoke. Call it what it is. This explains a beautiful idea. It says the following. Why? Also, we need to understand a different thing. If you look, the fire when Hashem came down on Har Sinai on the day of Matan Torah, it says Hashem came down in fire. But it doesn't say it was a consuming fire. Here, the fire that was there for the 40 days, it says Ka'esh Oicheles, it was a consuming fire. Now, why did Hashem generally come down in fire? What is the concept of smoke? Let's understand how smoke works. And let's understand the whole purpose of Matan Torah. See, the Or HaChaim says something very interesting on that pasuk. He says, Hashem came down in fire and it was smoking. He says, that's interesting. He says, it's a miracle. Because smoke happens not when there's fire. Smoke happens when fire burns something. When there's a clash between the fire and the thing that it's consuming, that's when you have smoke. Correct? If you have a pure fire, there's very little smoke. When you're burning something, that's when it's smoke, right? If you have candles, there's no smoke. I mean, there's a little bit of smoke, but not that kind of cloud of smoke that we're talking about here. Smoke, the thickness of the smoke, really is when the fire is consuming something. Says the Rechaim, Har Sinai was stone. Complete stone. There was no trees, no grass, no flowers. So what was smoking exactly? Says the Rechaim was a bit of a miracle. What happened was in Har Sinai is that the mountain started to smoke. What's the idea behind it? The idea is as follows. The purpose of Matan Torah, right, as we know, the difference between pre-Matan Torah and post-Matan Torah was the merging of holiness, spirituality, godliness, and physicality. We know that one of the things that we are taught before Matan Torah, there was Torah study, there were great tzaddikim, there were great people. But the world was completely unchanged. This idea that we have today, as we know, that you can take something holy, something godly, and it should permeate and affect and change a physical thing, that's a post-Matan Torah phenomenon. The world before Matan Torah was incompatible with godliness. The two do not meet. Right? Post-Matan Torah, we were given the mission, which is actually the purpose of creation, for the fire of Hashem to consume the world. Consume doesn't world, the world doesn't mean in a destructive way. Consume the world means in a holy way. Consuming means to elevate. Okay, which is a hard struggle. In other words, what we need to do is engage with the physical world, bring Torah, bring Ruchnius, bring spirituality, bring God into the physical world by being connected to God and also engaging with the physical world and bringing the two together so that God is absorbed in the world. That's a concept of a consuming fire, and that's the idea of a fire generating smoke, because that's a struggle. Because when the fire of Hashem connects with the world, the struggle begins. And that struggle produces smoke. That smoke is a sign of the struggle. It's a sign of the resistance. It's a sign of the whole process happening. Now we know with smoke, the more resistant something is, the more smoke it will... If you burn something that's moist, and there's more resistance, you get more smoke. Maybe less fire, but more smoke. Right? So what happens like this. This thing happens on two stages. Because for this concept, for us to bring God into the world, Hashem wants us to do it. We have to do it. But the way the world was created, it would be impossible for us to do it. The world was so incompatible with godliness that it's almost impossible to take something gashmir, something physical, and make it holy. So Hashem said, okay, what we do is like this. When it comes to Matan Torah, we're going to do this in two stages. I'm going to prepare the world. I'm going to descend in fire. I'm going to make the first indent, so to speak, in the world to make it less resistant. And then it's over to you. So what happens is like this. Hashem comes down on our Sinai. We read in the Pasuk, and Hashem doesn't call it any euphemisms on that day. Hashem comes down in a fire, and Hashem says, I'm going to affect every part of the world, even the inanimate objects, even the stones. And suddenly there's this explosion of volcanic fire. There's huge smoke. Hashem doesn't call it a cloud. He calls it Oshan. Har Sinai Oshan Kulo, the mountain is smoking. Why? Because at that day, there was tremendous resistance. And Hashem had to impose himself on the world. The result being this huge smoke on Har Sinai, to which the people trembled as a sign of the war has begun, the first indent has been made, the world is now ready for you to finish the job. Finishing the job was then represented by Moshe Rabbeinu going up on the mountain post Matan Torah. That was a model of what we have to do. Says the Torah, no more clouds. Clouds was like a remote detached thing, purity. Har Sinai is fire, because now we need to bring the two together. Says the Torah, however, now Moshe Rabbeinu goes up the mountain, he's not going up in a cloud, he's going up in smoke, but we call it a cloud. Kamin Oshan Rashi, that's like a cloud, like ash. Why? Because it wasn't such bad smoke, because the resistance had been downgraded. When Moshe Rabbeinu went up on the mountain, and when we go up on the mountain, which means when we now continue on with what Moshe Rabbeinu learned, we need to know that we have to engage, but we need to know that Hashem made the first indent for us. When we engage, it's a struggle. We have to engage with the physical world. We cannot detach ourselves. We have to bring the Torah into the world. And there will be a struggle, but the struggle is more like a cloud. It is ash, but it's like a cloud. It's a refined ash, because the world is much less resistant, even though it doesn't look that way sometimes, but we need to know that it is. Then comes Rashi and says, okay, no problem. But a Jew is still afraid. A Jew says, you know, you give me the Torah, I'm much better off. Let me just hide, and I'll detach from the world. I'm worried, because we know that when you get into a struggle, there's a Talmudic saying that says, "Kol ha'oisek im ha'manuvel misnavel." You know, if you fight with someone really bad, you become bad. You become affected, you become tainted. So it just says, I don't like this mission. I don't like this mission Hashem has given me post-Matan Torah, that I have to stain myself, impure myself for ourselves. Why do I have to engage in the physical world? It's much easier not to do that. It's much easier to remain pure. It's much easier to be like Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, who could sit and learn Torah all day and not even deal with the world. Let the world take care of itself. Why do I have to do this? And I'm afraid, the Yid is afraid. The Yid says, if you want me to leave the Shir and then take it into the world and share the light into the world, I'm afraid of being affected more than I will influence. Says Rashi, V'osa HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Moshe Shvil. Hashem says, no. Because what Hashem does when you go into that ash, when you go into that smoke, Hashem makes you a pathway. Hashem makes a pathway for Moshe Rabbeinu to remain pure even while he's amongst them. In other words, as Chassidus explains, we all have what's within us, what's called a spark of Moshe Rabbeinu, which we learn from a different part of the Chumash. We all have that connection to the Neshama, which is called the Moshe of our Neshama. We all have a little bit of Moshe Rabbeinu's purity within us. And we all have the ability to engage with the world and yet retain our purity. In other words, we have to know as a Yid, the way we engage with the world is different the way a person normally engages with the world. We have to engage with the world, we have to live a natural life, we have to fight with the world, we have to bring Kedusha, we have to bring holiness. But at the same time, we have to live there but not be there at the same time. We have to be able to retain that purity. And we can retain that purity because Hashem creates that pathway for us. We're able to be in the smoke and yet not be in the smoke at the same time. And that's the way we're able to do what Hashem wants. That's why the first time, by the way, it doesn't say it was a consuming fire. Because the first time was Hashem's indent generally into the world, but it wasn't yet absorbed completely. The second fire is about being a consuming fire, because that's what we're able to take it and should be absorbed completely into the whole world. Okay?
Yeah, that's yeah. Glory.